Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's December 5th, 2021, and welcome to episode 247 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and things that happen all the time, I guess, something like that. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts, the first of whom on my screen is Quinn Dunkey in Los Angeles. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. It's a retro computing triangle today because we're apparently the only ones not murdering trees.
Yeah, exactly. Or yeah, at least right now murdering trees. Yes. The tree murdering may have happened earlier.
I murdered yesterday.
Not actively murdering, yeah. Well, yeah, our murder is deferred.
Also joining us is Blake Patterson in Northern Virginia. How are you?
I'm doing well. And yes, and as indicated, I did murder a tree yesterday. We actually, my wife and I had different customs as far as trees. She always used a real tree. We always used a kind of a fake tree. She liked those big, the big light bulb lights, and I like the tiny lights. So we compromise. We use a real tree with tiny lights.
A real tree with like burning candles.
I was thinking like an undead tree with medium lights. I feel like that would be the compromise.
So sadly, yes, because of my wife, I do kill a large plant every year unnecessarily. In what was a pagan ritual, but I don't think that's really how it's framed these days. So, yeah. Anyway, there it is. Otherwise, I'm doing well.
Excellent. Yeah, I don't think we've ever really had a tree. We did fashion a tree it's sort of like a clothes hanger that has, we hung sort of things off of it at one point. Because we decided we didn't want a tree. There's no point in having a tree. And then at the last second, we said, well, actually, maybe we do. You know, so we took what was around.
Is that approaching a Festivus pole?
I mean,
that
pretty close.
Sounds closer to
that is, yeah. That's one bend away from being a Festivus pole.
Yes. The feats of strength, the airing of grievances. Yeah. Yes.
We talked a little bit last time, I guess maybe that may have been offline, about like what the topic would be for this time. And Carrington came up with the idea of, you know, this is episode 247, which is a little bit like 24/7, you know, so maybe we could talk about things that, you know, we did nonstop or we used every day, or, you know, the computer with our longest uptime or the first server we ever had. And that's as far as we got. So I don't know if we have anything, if that inspired anything just now, as I said it, I doubt any of us really gave a lot of thought to this topic ahead of time.
I have a possible, because I have a question for the panel, if it were. So
okay.
There used to be a myth or a truth. Tell me if you think this is true. People used to say that you should leave your computer on all the time, that that's actually better for it, rather than powering it up and powering it down all the time. And people had a lot of different reasons for this involving, heating it up and cooling it down, or the power supply, you know, takes the most wear at startup, or things like, people used to say the same thing about light bulbs. It was supposed to be better for them to leave them on all the time, incandescent bulbs. Mm-hmm. I think that's definitely not true for light bulbs, but I think that same urban legend kind of transferred to computers. Did you guys ever hear that? People used to say, leave your Apple II on all the time.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah, I know. I heard that. It always seemed a little strange. With cars too, actually. You know, like that. That's the other thing. I always thought it was like, you know, taxing on a car to start it. And now, you know, whenever you rent a car, they all turn themselves off whenever you stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is true that idling is bad for the engine. So that I think that's where that legend comes from. And, you know, starting the car, of course, also the battery will go dead if you do it too much without running the car. But modern cars are so much better about managing all that stuff anyway, so it doesn't hurt them nearly as much. But yeah, back in the like 60s or whatever, it wasn't so good to let your car idle.
I think I have my first hybrid car, it is, they at least this one, and I think many use an engine that's not designed to provide a lot of upfront power. I think it's an Anderson engine is the technology and what I've got. And I think it's much easier for it to start, but when it starts, it gives you very little, you know, torque until it gets up to speed. Hence, you've got the battery. But as for your point with the computers, I definitely heard that. And, you know, I guess I when I did hear that, it was about the time that I got my first, I mean, I guess the first PC that I really stuck with, which was like 90. I mean, it was a big PC. I got a loan for it. I was in college. It was like 94. I bought it to run Next Step. It was a 486 with a ridiculous 16 megs of RAM, which was insane. It was like, you know, $1,500 worth of memory. About that time I heard, I think I was on the news groups and, you know, people were saying, of course, Unix system always on, there's reasons, benefits to operate it that way that aren't to do with longevity. But I did hear that the drive spin up, the power supply, even hitting the chips with the startup voltage. So from that point on, any significant, you know, modern system, I've always left it on. And that was, so it's been, you know, 25 years or whatever. My gaming PC here, the iMac, and everything that came before it, all the way back to college, I've never turned them off, unless I had to, you know, install something. I don't do that with the retro computers. My 2GS over here has actually been on for 3 days because I've been using it a lot. But I figure they're so old that you get into capacitor issues. You know, I'm not worrying about caps on the systems I'm going to use for like 4 years and then replace with a new modern system. So I don't do that with the retro things. But I think there might be some truth to it with, you know, for instance, hard drives they want to be hot. You know, like they operate more safely and better after they heat up. You know, they're not as, the distances between things in like platters are aimed at usage temperatures for the ideal gap, so to speak. So,
Although the counter argument to that would be, I mean, the primary point of failure on hard drives and power supplies are the moving parts, the bearings, and in fans and spindles. So I would suspect that it's probably worse for longevity to leave them running just because of that. I mean, again, modern hard drive spindles are so good that they, you know, they outlive their usefulness mechanically anyway. But I would suspect that it's probably slightly better to shut them off for longevity. But again, it never matters because they don't wear out anyway. But
yeah, I mean, when I started doing it, I mean, you know, you turn on the drive and it sounded like a helicopter. You know, these are drives that were like, you know, very old drives relative to today. So yes, I'm sure they're much more efficient. It's just like you don't need to break in. You definitely wanted to treat your car a certain way when you got a new car with a new engine. You don't really have to do that anymore. They typically ship with like synthetic oil, and everything is machined exactly precisely. There's not like that critical break-in period, you know, where you want to vary the speed. And as you say, idling was horrible more in the past than now, I'd say, probably. But
yeah, it's interesting. With retro computers, I think, just because I don't tend to actually use them a lot, maybe that'll change. But I am not tempted to leave them on just because I just think, you know, at some point there's gonna be some, you know, power supply cap exploding or something. I need to get actually the one that I intend to use here. I need to get a modern supply in. I have a 2GS here that has a modern power supply in it. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I used to leave my 8-bit Apple II on for very long periods at a time. I would shut the monitor off because, of course, that uses a lot of power and makes noise, and it's, you know, obviously not good for the tube to be powered up. So I would just shut the monitor off. But with my 2GS, that was the first machine where I stopped doing that largely just because of noise, honestly, because it was my first machine with a hard drive and my first machine with a fan. And so, I mean, that thing was loud, like those, especially those 80s fans and 80s hard drives. I mean, it sounded like a jet engine when it was running. And so I shut it off just because I didn't want to live with the noise. But I would also be curious if anyone's calculus on this has changed, you know, in the world of climate change when we're trying to conserve energy as much as possible, if people might shut things off more because of that.
Mm-hmm. Although the computers did come right on the tail end of, like, you know, the oil crises or whatever, right? So there's probably a lot of energy concern right at the outset too.
Yeah, I mean, with retro computers, the power consumption was 90% the monitor. Like, CRTs use way more juice than a half dozen TTL chips do. You know, I mean, that's, they're measured in milliwatts, and the monitors are measured in hundreds of watts. But modern computers, I think that's interestingly, that ratio is flipped. LCDs are incredibly power efficient, and modern, you know, graphics cards and so on are using thousands of watts. So it's pretty crazy how that's flipped, actually.
Yeah, it occurs to me that, like, one scenario that would cause my computer, you know, my Apple II at least, to stay on was the overnight download, you know.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, because, this something was going to take hours and hours to come across, so I would, I would turn off the monitor, go to bed.
Yeah, on my laser, I used a RAM disk extensively, largely for downloads, because, for, like, multi-floppy games, you know, it was the only way to download them if you didn't have some kind of mass storage. So a RAM disk was a great way to do that. But then, obviously, you have to leave it on because it's a RAM disk.
Right.
I would always, definitely, with the computers I always left on, especially with the CRT, like, I didn't have it go to screensaver. And if it wouldn't actually sleep, I would, you know, turn the CRT off at night. For power, but also for wear. It's not great on CRTs to be out all the time. But yeah, they certainly generate some heat and take some power.
Well, that's actually, you know, so it occurs to me that that's something that the classic Macs can't do. Like, because it's all in one unit, you can't say, I would like the CRT to be off, rather than doing your dumb little fireworks.
You mentioned sleep there, and interestingly, so that's so built into modern computers. Like, now that I think about it, I haven't shut off a computer really in several years. I mean, I haven't had a desktop since the early 2000s. I've been all laptops. And, of course, laptops never shut off unless you consciously do so for some reason, which you very rarely do. I can't remember the last time I shut off a computer just from having switched to laptops, which is actually kind of interesting how that's changed the usage patterns as well.
Right. Some systems like the Mac has, you know, you can sleep. You know, you can sleep the monitor. I guess you can do it to PC, Windows, same settings. You can, you know, I always sleep the monitor on this LCD on these things. If I can, I'll let the system sleep. But again, keeping with my belief, I always tell it not to sleep the drives. And I actually have a utility on the Mac that keeps the arrays awake. The array that just failed awake so that it can run all the time.
Coincidence.
Although that's the array that I mentioned before the show started that it happened to have failed. So Quinn may have some points there, but
Intuitively, though, I get where you're coming from. I have a very small two-disc RAID that is my backup drives and my media server behind me here. And it's two Buffalo mechanical spindles, and they sleep themselves automatically. It's built into their firmware. And so basically every time I open the lid on my Mac, on my MacBook, or if I've been not using the file system for a while, I hear them spin up and spin down over there on the other side of the room. And it's a little stressful every time it happens, like these,
because
they sound awful when they start up. Like, they sound like they're just working so hard. But I mean, is that just in my head? Is it really actually not a big deal to do that? I don't know, but it is mildly stressful every time I hear those drives spin up and clunk and clunk and clunk and seek and clunk and do all this stuff. And then finally they show up in the Finder, and I didn't even want to use them. It's just because I brought a Finder window to the front.
Right.
So, you know, macOS does something and wakes up all the drives.
Yeah. Right. It's like on the 2GS, if you're like, oh, I'd like to open a file, let me go back and choose a different disk, and it'll sit there and spin every floppy disk, especially if you have 5 1/4.
Oh, the 5 1/4 on a GS are awful.
For it to go and check and check and check. Yeah. And like, no, I just wanted to go to the other one. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to always leave an empty disk in all of my 5 1/4 on the GS because having it scan them all was just awful if there was no disk in there. It would take it 5 minutes to decide there was nothing in the drive.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, I've been feeling that like today.
That was never, you know, I never really made the switch to ProDOS in the Apple II world, and I think that probably contributed to it, because like I remember having this happen, you know, so often. It's just like, you know, now I have to wait for nothing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, well, in the GS, like it would pull all the drives at just the stupidest times. Like you sort of develop a superstition about using GSOS to not do certain actions that you knew were going to trigger a drive pull.
Right.
And because if you had a typical GS setup would be 2 3.5s and 2 5 1/4s. And yeah, the pulling 2 5 1/4s to decide there was nothing in them was just painful. And it was like 5 minutes, well, not literally 5 minutes, but it was what felt like 5 minutes of rattling and clanking and thrashing of the drive.
It makes that horrible noise. It does one of those little, it hits you with that horrible ratchet thing that
the worst noise that drive makes for like 10 seconds straight, because it's trying to be a very modern OS, and one of the things, you know, modern OSs do is they know what's in all their drives all the time, but it's doing it with this, you know, 70s floppy disk technology that was not designed for that.
I remember the, like, as a kid, young teenager, I'd be like, after my bedtime, I would have to take my Apple IIc. And I would remember pulling the blanket off my bed and sort of ensconcing the 2C with it, so that when it did its initial boot up, it would do that, and then it wouldn't wake up my parents. And good Lord, if you had to like format a disk, you had to doubly wrap it with your blanket, because it did the, it's terrible.
It's funny. Even newer systems with designed with that in mind still work kind of funny that way. We'll talk a little bit later in the show about my recent Amiga experiences, but I got some Amiga stuff up and running, and this is old news to Amiga people, but by default, it just sits there and it pulls the 3.5-inch drive. If you're booting from hard drive, it just sits there and pulls the drive indefinitely. The entire time you're using the computer, it just sits there and just makes a little click noise to just check if there's a disk in there. But it does it like once a second for eternity. It never stops, and it's really odd that they designed it that way. So one of the first things I had to learn was that you can install extensions that stop that, because you really want to stop that. I can't imagine how annoying that must have been on physical hardware in the early days.
I think it was earlier 3.5-inch drives, and the cheaper ones didn't have the ability to detect, because I think like the Mac drive could tell.
Yeah.
But like to detect if there was a disk in it. And so like this, they're like, okay, we might end up using any available drive at some point in the future. Yeah, but yeah, the utilities that stop it are nice. No click.
Some of the cooler GS demos would detect disk inject, because the original GS 3.5-inch drives had no way to do that. And I don't know exactly how this worked. GS people can maybe chime in on this, but like when you were running the certain FTA demos and it would ask you to insert a disk, you'd see the drive light would be illuminated, but dimly, because it was flickering on and off really, really fast. And so it was just sort of dimly illuminated, and it was doing, but it was silent, but it was doing some trick involving waking up the drive motor or the head to detect when you had inserted a disk, and it worked beautifully. And I to this day, I don't know how they did that, but it was a really cool trick.
By the way, just to put in some, Curtis wrote in the chat that, my Coco 3 has been on for development for a couple of months straight now. So that's pretty good. It was generally good with capacitors.
It's funny. While I left my 8-bit Apple IIs on for months at a time, I feel really bad doing that now. Like, I never leave my 2C Plus on for any longer than absolutely necessary, because I just feel like I'm stressing them out, all these old chips. But I don't know if that's true or not, but I feel bad leaving it on.
Well, I've been doing so much stuff with like modern hardware, you know, like I'm surrounded by stuff from the 80s, but everything is like, you know, applesauce and Raspberry Pis and stuff like that. So like, I guess occasionally I will, when I'm one of the projects I'm doing, I will talk about, I guess, at the end, but, is, you know, like imaging a lot of stuff and scanning a lot of stuff. And so as I image the disks, sometimes, you know, it comes up with failure modes and like I image and image and image. And eventually I think, you know, I wonder if I should just see if the disk actually works, you know. So that's when I will use the retro thing. I will put the disk in the actual Apple II and I will start it up, and the disk turns out doesn't actually work. So that would explain why I kept getting all these errors.
Speaking of changing usage patterns, it's funny how on the retro computers, I always kind of liked rebooting because it, you knew the machine was in a clean and safe state then, especially with, like with the GS. I mean, it tried to do a lot of pseudo multitasking and stuff, and you know, it didn't have hardware memory protection and all this. So it was, the longer you used it, the less stable it got. You know, early Macs were notorious for this as well. So rebooting felt good, but now I hate rebooting. Like, so yesterday I had to reboot my laptop here for some, I forget why. And it takes like, I don't know, several minutes before everything is like back up to where it was and running efficiently. And the machine, like, you know, they finished the boot in the background basically. And so things are still starting up and loading for several minutes and everything's all slow and it loses your Windows and oh, it's terrible.
Yeah.
So, hate rebooting.
One of the things that I know that I was like worried about with like changing, like turning the computers on and off was the power button itself. You know, like I currently worry about that. Like I got, I have a sort of a, it's like a remote power button that I'm going to install on the Apple II Plus there so that I can sort of like actually turn it on and off without stressing out the rocker switch.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you can still buy those rocker switches. I think that design is eternal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if the psychology of feeling good about powering things up and down changes based on the physical hardware as well, because I never thought twice about powering my Apple II up and down because it had just, you know, that little rocker on the back. But the first PC I got was my dad's PC XT clone at his office. He got it to run his clinic, his veterinary clinic. And, you know, you remember those generations of PCs, they had that giant red toggle paddle switch thing.
Right.
And it just felt like you were starting up a nuclear reactor when you flipped that thing. And that made me hesitant to shut it off and on because it just felt like a switch that big, it must be doing something stressful. I don't know. So I resisted shutting it off ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very distinctive switch.
What is, I know what was fun about the Apple II power switch was that, and this is probably true for, you know, everything of the era, but if you went super quick, almost nothing got lost. I mean, like, yeah, so it was like if your game hung, it sometimes it was actually worth it to try going like to just momentarily, you know, flip the power to see if you could get control back without actually losing the stuff in memory.
Yeah.
But usually you lost, you know, every fifth byte or something.
Yeah, it varied machine to machine too. Like the Apple II reboot, like powering it off and on was a pretty dramatic experience because the drive would, you know, rattle and do all this and it would beep and all this. But like Commodore 64s, when you power them off and on, it's like nothing even happened because it's sitting on the blue Commodore basic screen and you flip it on, flip it off. It makes no noise. Drive doesn't do anything. Nothing happens. It just comes back to that blue screen. So I wonder if that also makes people more inclined to shut them off and on, also because the Commodore had no reset, which was a very strange omission. But yeah, it just felt like nothing to power the Commodore up and down, even though for the hardware, it's the same amount of stress as the Apple II, but the Apple II just seemed like it was doing more on boot up with the beeping and the drive rattling and everything.
Yeah.
Felt like more of an event to reboot.
Yeah, I guess the Commodore had that. Right. If you didn't have a disk drive, then you just had the cassette. And if you had a drive, everything was going to load through there. And the Commodore had that cartridge, you know, it and the Atari had the cartridge port, which I guess. But yeah, it is weird without the reset on that thing. I think most of the fast load cartridges, you know, built added a reset button.
Yeah. That was a common addition. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the Commodore wins. We've talked a lot about how retro computers, it's nice how quickly they enter an interactive state. You know, modern computers, it's minutes before you can do anything. Mm-hmm. I think Commodores win the award on that. Like, even as an Apple snob back in the day, I was always impressed with how you could just, you flip that tiny little switch on the side of a Commodore and bang, like you could type basic code just instantly. Whereas the Apple, there was still a little bit of foo-for-ah. I mean, if you didn't have a disk drive, it was pretty instant, but
yeah.
You had to boot, you know, DOS 3.3 or something before you could do stuff, really.
Yeah. I think most of the Ataris, the A8s, would do like a little self-test, or they do something first. I mean, I have one, but it wasn't my main gig, so I can't remember exactly. But yeah,
Curtis in the chat says it's funny now that with some of the newer RAM upgrades based on static RAM instead of dynamic, they require you to leave the power off longer to get a clean reboot. Because I mean, like that's another one of these superstitions, like touching the power supply. I always touch the power supply whenever I do anything inside the computer, even if it's not plugged in. So it's doing nothing at all. but I always, like, you turn it off and you just like wait a couple seconds before you turn it back on, or else you're not going to have a clean start.
That's very real on the 2C+. I don't remember if the original 2Cs were like this as well, but you have to shut it off and you have to count to 2 or 3 before you turn it back on again, or the machine won't come back up at all. It'll just show garbage on the screen and the drive won't start. So there's a real thing there where the RAM RAM for some reason on that machine is very slow to like finish shutting down. There must be some big capacitors in there or something. That took getting used to when I first got my 2C+, because I hadn't had an Apple II in decades and I'd forgotten. Or at least maybe the other models may not have been quite this bad. But yeah, you really do have to flip it off, count to 3 before you flip it back on again.
I think some of the more recent add-ons, like, you know, the CFFA 3000, I have one in my 2E and the 2GS. It's on the 2E, I've noticed, I believe I'm remembering the right device, but it would, because it has an onboard system itself, you know, that of course is orders of magnitude faster than the Apple II that hosts it. But when you turn the power off, I think whether it's due to the Apple trickling power to the board, it needed considerably longer than you might think for it to completely lose, you know, shut itself. Or maybe I'm thinking about the VidHD. One of the two.
That one is a little bit more serious computer.
Yes, it has a lengthy boot process, and yes, that's I think that you could run, like, you could probably do desktop work on that system if you had the right package put on it. Yes, I think it was the VidHD, actually.
Cool. Okay, so that was pretty good, actually, for not having a topic.
We always find something to talk about for 20 minutes. That's never a problem.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I'll my parting thought would be, I guess, ironically, the most lengthy retro-related, uptime, always on, would be the web servers that I rent to run my retro blogs, because they're always up, but they don't live with me. They're not even actual machines. They're virtual blade systems. But yes, that, I guess, one way or another, my main blog, I guess it's been 17 years that some system has been running and basically all the time keeping it alive. So, but not cool. as retro as the machines we typically talk about.
Yeah, I wonder actually with uptime is kind of, one can be kind of proud of a machine that's been up for a long time or whatever, but like when you have something that's like on Amazon, cloud or whatever, like I wonder if that concept even means anything anymore,
Yeah, it's losing it a lot. I mean, at my day job, of course, it's all cloud infrastructure stuff that we do. And yeah, I mean, so we have service contracts and they guarantee a percentage of uptime, which is, industry standard is sort of like 99.97, I think, percent. Or maybe it was 99.7, I forget. It boils down to like a couple of hours a year, basically, that it's allowed to be down contractually. And yeah, the way they do that is everything's virtual, and they can, they can switch your instance from physical hardware. Like your virtual server is moving around between different physical machines all the time, and you don't even know. It's all transparent. It is sort of magical.
Indeed. I just SSH'd into my web server, the web server that I rent from a group, and it looks like that instance has been up for 202 days. 202 days, 1 hour and 48 minutes. This Mac has been up for 6 days, 1 hour and 32 minutes. So when the array failed, I had to reboot.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's an old Unix nerd thing to brag about your uptime too. I remember we used to do that back in the SGI days. There was little people would run little shell scripts that showed your uptime on the corner of the screen all the time, so you could brag to your sysadmin friends.
You could get it to have your I had a script that would update my finger file. You remember finger?
Oh yeah.
Type finger
yeah,
user.
Finger, yeah.
And it would give you. It would update my finger file with all kind of stupid geeky things like the uptime of the system and.
Yeah, you know, yeah. People used to put their uptime in their dot plan files and other Unix nerd things.
I think for most of the time that I had a dot plan file, it just contained the text dot schman.
I get it. That's good.
Yeah.
that's good.
Okay, let's see. So we have a little bit of listener feedback. People are still sending us feedback, even though we don't actually show up in their podcast feeds. Which is nice. So maybe I'll jump to a little bit of that. So David on the Facebook page put a link to Retro Magazine World number 11. It's basically, of course I should have done some research, like Reddit or whatever, but I'm just reporting that a link was provided, I guess. This is issue number 11. So it's 11. November... Yeah, it goes to 11. Soon it will go to 12, I assume. But it's November 2021. This is the English version, and it's a very large sort of retro-themed magazine. It's got discussion of Galaga on the Commodore 64, a hardware review of the Apple II, ZX Mastermind, 93 pages. It's impressive. I'm interested in reading this. I have not even begun, really. I'm just scrolling through it now. But
is it a digital magazine?
It is definitely digital is an option. I don't know if physical is an option or not. Retromagazine.net. Does anyone know in the chat?
I don't know.
I've actually not heard of this one.
We might have talked about one earlier version of it. It also exists in other languages too. It was posted as being the English version, but what is
Curtis
this?
In
is
the chat
Italian?
Is saying that this is originally an Italian magazine, and that it's now available in other languages as well.
Nice. I think it would be pretty interesting to also get the European perspective too.
Yeah, it's interesting. All of my other niche hobby magazines have all gone all digital and are slowly going that way because, it's a way to cut all your overhead and still serve a tiny market.
Right.
So, I would not be shocked if this was all digital.
Yeah, my guess is it is all digital, but it's whatever. It's great content, and half the time I would prefer it to be digital anyway. So
yeah, well, and I prefer this. I saw earlier that this is 93 pages this issue, which is pretty great for a niche hobby magazine.
Yeah,
some other ones. One of my other hobbies is Live Steam, and so the Live Steam magazine that I get is still physical, but in order to cut their costs, what they're doing is the magazine keeps getting thinner and less often. So it's now quarterly and it's 15 pages. Whereas if they just went all digital, maybe they could do it more often and have it be thicker, which I would frankly prefer. I don't care so much about having the physical product.
There was a magazine for the Apple II called Soft Talk that was a big thing among Apple II users. But that you could, what you saying that reminds me very much of the tail end of Soft Talk. It started being all ads, very small, and then suddenly it was just gone.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and back then that was the only way they had to keep going was to keep cutting costs, in other ways. But yeah, now they can just get rid of the paper and the shipping and the production and the layout and all that. And I guess you just still have to do layout, but get rid of the printing and shipping costs. And now, that's probably most of your overhead, I would imagine. I'm sure Ken Gagne is screaming at his podcast player right now because I'm sure oversimplifying the challenges of publishing a magazine. But
this does look beautiful, though. I mean, the layout is really nice on this retro magazine.
It is nice.
It is nice. Yeah.
It's shelf space is less of a draw anyway, as the bookstores slowly go away. Sadly. Mm-hmm. That reminded me. I've been subscribing to Retro. It's a British magazine called Retro Gamer. Mm-hmm. It's been around since 2004, and they've been physical the entire time. They I guess a few years after they started, they added PDF versions as well. But it's still, I've got like many bookshelf units that are just filled with them, and that's kind of nice to hold in your hand. But that does look very nice. I'm interested in this magazine that you presented here.
Yeah, Retro Gamer is beautifully produced. That's a very, it's a really nice magazine. I think that's broad enough. Retro gaming is still a broad enough market that they can afford to do a paper magazine there. But yeah, retro and computing and some of these other hobbies are getting too niche, I think.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, the retro gaming, it's interesting because like a good little chunk towards the end is about like people are actively writing modern, you know arcade ports or, retro, new takes, and now everybody's coming out with the new consoles that look like a shrunken down version of everything. And so there's a lot to write about. But of course with all the FPGA stuff and with all the, the retro computing hobby, I feel like it's kind of growing. So I don't know. We'll see how that.
Yeah. We'll see if it continues after all of us die. I suspect it may taper off here in the next 15 or years or so. I don't know if young people are going to be nostalgic for the iPhone 3G or whatever, but I can't imagine.
I know virtual is different, but how many people, Paul, and I guess also Quinn, say under 25 would attend Kansas Fest, say in the past 5 years, the physical Kansas Fest?
Oh, I mean, I think there were a couple of people, kids who were brought along.
Yeah.
And enthusiastic.
I saw some kids. I sort of felt bad for the kids. Oh, they were? Okay. Because I sort of felt bad for the kids. I was like, oh, Dad's dragging me.
Yeah, no, I think
maybe not.
I think that the kids that were there were into it, but they really did number like two or three,
Yeah. In the pictures, I've seen like one or two kids every time, but.
Well, and retro gaming has a strong young following. There's are plenty of Twitch streamers and so on who are under 25 who are showing retro games, but that's like they don't have any emotional attachment to the hardware, and to them it's all the same.
Yeah.
They don't but there is an aesthetic appeal to the old games, the pixel graphics and the simpler gameplay. And that effect is actually kind of going virtual. So there are retro style games and retro, modern retro-ish systems like the Pico 8. And there's that new one that's all black and white that's got the crank on it.
With the crank. Yeah.
Yeah, I forget what it's called. But systems
I can't think of the name of it.
Yeah, but systems like that are very popular. So people like the aesthetic and the feel of retro stuff. I guess the same way that like hipsters now buy vinyl records, but maybe they aren't even old enough to have bought vinyl back in the day. Same thing, I think.
Playdate.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Playdate, that's it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the Playdate. It's a very elegant device.
It is. It's
I do
pretty
like
cool.
It, but
yeah, it's a cool
I mean,
thing.
I wouldn't mind one. I don't think I'm going to buy one. But, it's like, I know having run that iOS game site for some years way back when, I know a good number of game developers. And, some of them, they'll just basically take an existing game, maybe a basic language, a fairly simplistic game, and then just with GPUs, they'll just write a shader, and it pixelates. This shader now turns this game into a retro game. It's just visual shaders. So.
Or there's a lot of young folks that are doing remakes of old games on modern engines. Like there's a bunch of Ultima remakes that are done in Unity, in voxel or other 3D rendering methods. But reproducing the feel of the old game, but fully modern game engines. So Paul's got the Playdate up on the screen.
This is ridiculous.
Showing the Playdate on the screen. That looks pretty cool, Paul. That looks kind of nice. That's fun.
The crank actually is a controller.
Yeah,
like a functional thing.
Forward and back.
It's basically a spinner like arcade games used to use, which is kind of funny. I don't think most people buying this realize that's what it is, but it is in fact.
So you could play Tempest.
Return of the spinner control. So yeah, it would be great for Tempest Major Havoc.
Nice. They should do it for physical fitness. I mean, if I had to turn a weighted set of foot cranks to play No Man's Sky, I'd probably be in a lot better shape. but sadly, that's not the case.
All right. Let's see. The next bit of feedback. This is a super non-timely. Particularly when they hear this on the feed, but on our Facebook group, Ennio posted about the World of Commodore 2021 that T-Pug is doing, Toronto Pet Users Group. So that is there's a physical and virtual edition. And I say there is, really, I should say there was. It was yesterday. So yeah, there was a, it was both via Zoom and YouTube and also in person. So you can't, if you're only just hearing about this now, you can't participate live, but you can look at the video. The video for the sessions is on YouTube still. I've managed to zoom in on a picture of the ceiling here, but anyway, so it's if you're interested in that and only just heard about it, they have a number of scheduled presentations. Bill Hurd, you know, is talking. Michael Tomczyk, various people sort of discussing things. So if you're interested in that, check that out, and then maybe next year go to the thing. So sorry about the announcing it the day after it happened, but there it is. And if you were in our Facebook group and you were not a robot, you would have possibly seen that announcement in advance. But okay, maybe I think maybe the last one I'll mention is Tony wrote over email to talk about a C64 emulator and Python, sort of. It's PyC64. There's a GitHub page for it, and so you know it's written in Python, and it does look like a Commodore 64. It doesn't. It's not exactly a full emulator, so like it doesn't entirely work with pre-written software, but you can run basic stuff. But you know, it's got a ways to go before it can be completely emulating it. But one thing that I think is pretty weird and wild is that it actually has a whole like Python, like you can just flip into Python mode and run Python on your Commodore 64 screen.
Oh wow, look at that. That's trippy.
Yeah, because I think actually the way it does BASIC is it's basically just, you know, it's sort of adding, it's doing a Python implementation of each of the BASIC commands, I think. But so, you know, as a side effect, it can just run Python too.
This is interesting. This isn't a genre of emulator that we're seeing a lot more of now, where they're sort of in this gray area between like emulator, simulator, and environment, kind of like Wine lets you run Windows software, but it's not actually a PC emulator. Mm-hmm. This is kind of in that ballpark. Like, yeah, it's hard to put your finger on what these things are really doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's kind of neat about this is that it's an interesting, weird project that someone is doing because they wanted to do a project, you know? I mean, like, it probably isn't really for anybody else.
Yeah.
It's a good reason to do a project.
Yeah. But it's still pretty involved. And I like it. It's cool. But
yeah, seeing that Python code on the C64 screen is pretty wild. It's hurting my brain a little bit.
Yeah, you flip back and forth between it. You can type Go64 to return to Commodore BASIC, or you can type, I think, GoPy to go into Python mode. So, but yeah. So, and you have, what is that, 40 columns?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Not a lot of real estate for a modern language.
Yeah.
Maybe version 2 of this will target a Commodore 128 with its 80-column display.
Yeah.
Of course, then you've got you could actually run like a CPM version of Python compiler. I don't know. It's complicated.
Anyway, okay. So I think we will. I will leave the feedback there. But thank you, people who are writing in. And if you have written in and we haven't mentioned it, hopefully we will not forget. So now I guess we could go to our items of interest and news. And Blake, you have the first of these.
Okay. The first item that I have is on Ken Schrift's blog. I don't know if anyone is familiar. I've been following this for
I read all his time. Posts. Quinn's They're nodding. Pretty awesome.
Yeah,
pretty deep dive stuff. Anyway, the Yamaha DX7 was the first or one of the first synthesizer chips, and it's used not as much in, you know, computers directly as in synthesizers in the early 80s. Actually, it was used for quite a while. Yamaha synthesizers, but some of the I think it was literally used in some of the MSX machines, and there are a number of MSX machines that use derivatives or sibling chips that are similar to the DX7, but a little bit lower end. But anyway, so there's this basically is just a he has taken hundreds of microscopic shots of the dye itself and put them together so you get an overall dye look. He walks you through, you know, just how the whole FM situation, frequency modulation, sound generation works. Talking about what the chip is doing. It's actually sort of like two little processors. CPUs at the time weren't powerful enough really to move data in such a way as to do what this does. And he talks a bit about the tricks and how it's done. One of the things I thought was interesting is multiplication. It was pretty expensive on computer hardware as compared to addition and subtraction, that kind of thing. But one of the interesting examples is that, you know, the chip uses, as I was reading, it caught my attention, the chip uses base two logarithms because adding logarithms is equivalent to multiplying values. And so it uses some of these like sort of hardware tricks to get this sort of heavy lifting, you know, comparative looking back, of course, lifting isn't that heavy today, but it's quite an in-depth look. Talking about the shift registers, you know, what happens, the logic diagrams. So it's interesting. It's sort of not a really light read, but I found it very interesting. And I some of the best things I see along these lines have come out of Kentris blog. So
yeah, I'm always proud of myself if I understand 50% of one of his posts. But
this was moved on. This was sort of a glossing over of many of the parts because it's way beyond my sphere. But interesting still.
Even if you don't follow all the technical details, I always still come away with feeling like I've learned something super interesting. Like because often it's just like he's done a bunch about x86 reverse engineering and just. Like he did a whole post about just how they routed power in the early x86 chips and how hard that was and the way they solved those problems. And that was super interesting, even if you don't understand all of the technical details of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love his blog.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the good, ideal sort of things to, you know, bring up at a party.
Right, oh, totally. Oh, yeah.
Logarithmic additions, you know.
Casual conversation.
Break the ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the... DX7, like I always thought of, I didn't think of this as a chip, but I guess it was the chip that's in this. But the Yamaha DX7 keyboard was a really big thing, in the music scene of the 1980s. So I have, let's see if I can find this. I have a TX7 that I got sort of specifically for that, which is like, it's like the Yamaha DX7 keyboard, except without the keyboard part. So it's just MIDI controlled, but it has, you know, it has the same sort of programmability and voice sounds that you had with the DX7. So
yeah. I think, you know, now that you mention it, looking at it, I think there's a Yamaha DX21 is a chip name, and that's used in one of Yamaha's MSX machines. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the little brother, as it was put. But yes, I think I've sort of misspoken. The DX7 actually utilized two Yamaha chips that were differently named.
I see.
The YM21290 and the 21280. One generated the waveforms, one was an envelope chip. Yes, so I misspoke, kind of going backwards from the other naming of the chips. So, yeah. That's a good correction there.
Yeah.
But yes, the DX7 was a very, very famous synthesizer that was used for quite some time, I think.
So I read an article a while back. I'm not a music person, so I'm sure I'll get the details wrong. But this article was saying that basically the DX7 and there was a Moog synthesizer, the 8008 or something, or the 404, something like that. Those two devices were basically the entire sound of the 80s. Like everything that we associate with that genre or that era of music came entirely from those two devices. And those just the way they happened to sound. So it's interesting what a cultural impact a couple of chip engineers had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ken's article mentions, like, you know, it was heavily used by, if you think of music from Aha, Michael Jackson, Dolly Parton, Whitney Houston, you know, like all of these people were, you know, like you can certainly picture all the synth sounds coming out of Aha, you know.
And that sort of like sketchy style.
Yeah. Back then they had to draw with pencil, you know, because the audio took so much power.
Anyway, this is all barely connected thoughts, but okay. Maybe I'll move on to my thing. And my thing is actually Ian's thing. But Ian pointed out to me that there's that Ian Baranofsky, who has appeared on the show. By the way, that's who Ian is. But this is a feedback that I held back. So it's an LCD replacement for the TRS-80 PC-1 or Sharp PC-1211. And it's a $20 thing, and it's pretty cool. So these are these little like calculator type computers, and they have a failure problem, which is that they, I don't know what the actually it is. It's moisture gets in and ruins the liquid crystal, I guess is what it says here. And so they can look like junk. And so what this is basically is a little replacement. It's greener rather than yellow, but you can sort of pretty much just drop it in sort of bring your calculator back to life. So, anyway, I think it's cool that this exists because, you know, it's not the kind of thing you could order from Radio Shack anymore or Sharp. Yeah,
that's cool. I wouldn't have thought that those were actually replaceable.
Yeah.
Because it is literally just liquid crystal sitting in the glass. Like, it's not like a module with cables attached. It's literally just the crystal. I'm surprised that's replaceable. That's cool.
Yeah. There's a video that sort of shows how it's done, too. Mm-hmm.
Maybe this was Ian as well, but I think yesterday, either on Twitter or maybe Instagram, I'm getting more and more retro people on Instagram as far as where I see things, where someone showed the little computer saying, I've just replaced the screen. And it had a new screen. I wonder if that was Ian. I don't know. I can't remember, and I can't seem to find it here. But it showed the end result of someone doing just this with clearly this product.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's a wave that's catching on.
Yeah,
perhaps.
But I did. I attempted to look for an example of one of the Radio Shack ones, TRS-81, and I think this suffers that problem. I'm not completely sure. I might be.
Yeah, that first screen you showed, that definitely looks like it's got the issue, doesn't it?
Yeah, and could benefit from it. I know I have some, half dozen of these, and probably some could use this. So,
was there? I didn't. Pardon me if I missed it. Mm-hmm. But is there an indication as to whether or not this can be used on a wide range of? I mean, a lot of these devices had similar screens, or is it?
It only lists these two, the TRS-80 PC-1 and the Sharp PC-1211, which I think are basically the same machine, just different badges.
Okay, yeah.
There's a little range of these things, and I don't know. It seems like if it's possible for this, it would be possible for others, but I don't know if this actual thing could fit in the others, right?
Sure.
Maybe when someone else is talking, I can dig out some of mine. I think I have a box here that says Calx PDAs, and probably it has some of them in it. But anyway, so if you have cool. A machine like this, you want to rehabilitate, this exists. So, all right, that's enough of that. Quinn, you can now speak about Amiga.
Yeah, so
finally, we've made it to the point where Quinn speaks about Amiga.
Yes, the least qualified person to speak about the Amiga. So for multiple episodes now, I've been talking about how I'm interested in the Amiga and I'm Amiga curious, as it were. But the barrier to entry feels high, and there is nothing along the lines of the new Apple II user's guide, where you can just get a book and it says, walks you through getting into a retro computer for someone who is in a modern context and might need to know about things like, SD cards and modern video and so on, as opposed to going to the books from the time period. So I was kind of stuck on figuring out how to get started. And it finally occurred to me to stop looking for books and start looking at YouTube. And I don't know why that never occurred to me, but I started looking at YouTube, and there are tons of great videos in exactly this space for how to get started with Amigas as a modern retro user. There are entire video playlists devoted to this. There are people focusing on people who had one back in the day and just need a refresher. There are people focused on some on people who've never touched an Amiga in their life. And so I'm linking to two of these videos in the show notes that I particularly liked. And this is a channel called the 10-Minute Amiga Retrocast. And he is he's done a two-part video on getting a beginner's guide to the Amiga, basically. So he goes over Workbench in the first video, and then the second video is going into the command line and partitioning hard drives, setting up sharing, and so on. It's really awesome. I mean, starting from absolutely nothing, I was able to. Now I'm doing this all in emulation. I don't have physical hardware, but starting from knowing absolutely nothing about this entire ecosystem, I was able to get a hard drive up and running and Workbench installed on it. And it's really a great walkthrough of all the basics. He assumes nothing about your knowledge of the machine or the ecosystem in general, which is exactly what I needed. So strong recommend for this pair of videos. Really, the only issues I had were differences between physical hardware and emulation. So I was doing this in emulation, and so there were some roadblocks around figuring out how to set up the Kickstart ROM for the emulator and also getting a hard disk image to mount in the emulator so that I could, like a blank image that I could then partition and format and install the OS on. So that was a little tricky. I didn't quite get that to work. I'm using FSUAE as the emulator, and it has two different types of hard drive images that it can create. So the launcher tool has the ability to create blank disk images, which is very nice. But for hard drive images, it can create single partition images or raw disk byte images, which are supposed to be partitionable. And I never got the latter to work. So I was only able to make very small hard drives, like 256 megabytes or less, because I could only use the other format. But the other trick is you have to launch the hard drive utility tool in Workbench with a special device driver option so that it's using the sort of fake device driver provided by the emulator to work with these disk images. So what was great about these two videos is that he prepared me to do that, because the emulator docs say, oh, just launch the hard drive tools with this option to recognize the device. And it was all just Greek, and I had no idea like how to even do any of that. But I had, after watching these videos, it was like, oh yeah, I know how to do that. I just go into execute and it's this. So really nice. Cool. Really like this video series. And sorry, cat issues. So strong recommend for these. And then the other thing that I want to recommend related to this, because I think for jumping into a new pseudo hobby like this, it's helpful to have a goal, something that you want to do, because you can get Workbench up and running. I installed it from 6 floppy images on my fake hard drive in the emulator, and it boots Workbench, and it's really cool. And then you're like, well, now what? I guess download some demos and watch those. That doesn't sound super exciting. So you have to kind of have a goal in mind. And my goal was to hopefully do some programming here at some point on the Amiga after I finish my 2GS project, which I will never finish. But it was a really fun experience. So on the stream here, I'm showing the second video in this series now, where he walks you through partitioning a hard drive and installing software on it. And then also he walks you through the basic Amiga shell, how the options work, startup sequence, how to run scripts at launch, some of the basic scripting and so on that you can do. And I mean, I kind of always knew from reputation that the Amiga OS was good, but I was really shocked at how good it is. Like it's astonishingly modern. It's very powerful. The multitasking is just flawless. It's so fast. Everything is so smooth, and it's really surprising. Like I was caught off guard by how good it is. I mean, the thing that it will do, where you can multitask multiple apps running at different screen resolutions, and it does this seamlessly by using horizontal blanking interrupts to split the screen vertically, and you can slide them up and down perfectly at like 60 FPS. Like it really is shocking how good it is. And the, you know, a lot of these early GUIs are sort of weird because we hadn't really figured out a lot of the basic paradigms for GUIs yet. But this one is very good. Like it, everything works kind of the way you expect. There's really only two weird things. The menu bar, you have to hold down right mouse button, which was a little odd. And then the windows move front and back based on a clicking on the corner of the window there instead of just clicking on them to bring them to the front. So, you know, a couple of minor oddities, but so much better than like Geos or Gem on the ST or some of those other early GUIs where everything's totally alien because we really hadn't established any visual language or UX language for GUIs yet. I was really impressed by all this.
Yeah, there's some interesting, like another, like the no-click utility for the floppy drive clicking. There's a click-to-front utility also that'll let you, it'll solve the problem.
Yes, I did find that as well, yeah. But, yeah, like I talked about at the top of the show, that was actually a fun exercise. You know, the video had mentioned, oh, you can get these no-click utilities, but he doesn't explain how to set one up to get the drive clicking to stop, so I was Googling that. I found AmiNet, the software archive, kind of the Asimov of Amiga, and I found one of these utilities. I downloaded that. Then I had to figure out how to install it, and I was able to work through all of that with the knowledge that he had given me in these videos for here's how you mount a disk image, and here's how you edit startup sequence to launch your little program at the start, and so on. So it was really cool to learn all of this stuff and then immediately apply it to something I wanted to achieve. It had a lot of that excitement of that computers had back in the day when everything was new and exciting and you were learning all these things and it was unlocking all of these tools to achieve your goals. It was fun to have that feeling again. I haven't gotten that from a retro computer really in a long time because I've really only always used Apple's II stuff for which I have nostalgia and for which I have an existing knowledge base. So to actually be going in wide-eyed and bushy-tailed again was really fun.
The scripting language, to add on to what you're saying, I think I told you we were chatting offline yesterday. I've got a ROM switcher in my Amiga, and like the built-in, you know, the scripting language that the shell scripting capabilities are such that, you know, I have a simple script that looks to see what the ROM revision is, and depending on that, like there's conditionals that fire off this or that startup script that, you know, pulls from this hard drive partition or that hard drive partition. So that's all just built in. You know, that was there. Those items were there as soon as, you know, hard drive support, hard drive booting was baked in well before the more modern gray interface that you showed back when it was a little more primitive with the blue. So impressive.
Yeah, it's shockingly good for 1985 on a home computer. I mean, it's got input redirection and pipes and all the, you know, all the modern like Unix shell stuff. It's got a lot of the best stuff from DOS and other command lines. The kind of app level scripting language, it's kind of its version of AppleScript, is also shockingly good. I definitely have a new respect for this thing. So moving along a little bit, so I talked about how it's really helpful to have a goal, and my goal was to do some programming. And so I found those videos just by actually Googling getting started with Amiga, and that was like the second hit or something. So I don't know why I didn't try that before. So then I Googled getting started with programming the Amiga, and that led me to a couple of different blogs, but this was the best one I found. And the title on this is a crash course to Amiga assembly language. And there's basically two categories of Amiga programming tutorials. They are if you want to do low-level stuff like demos and games, or if you want to write like workbench applications. And so this is the former, and it's a great walkthrough of, you know, from booting the machine to how do you access the video memory to, you know, all the basics. And it's all written again from a modern context, which I love. So the first thing he teaches you is how to set up a one-click build pipeline with the UAE emulator so that you can, you know, test and iterate on your code rapidly. So that's really cool. And then he talks about, you know, here's how to integrate with GitHub, and here's what modern cross-compiler, cross-assembler you should use. So it's very much a modern retro development approach to teaching you Amiga programming. And I have not yet read all the way through this, but from having skimmed it, I'm really impressed. It's got some cool demos that he's written to kind of get you started. And then he walks you through how they work, how an application is loaded, and how to then start interfacing with all the various specialty chips. So this link will be in the show notes as well. Strong recommend for this as an Amiga programming tutorial.
That's really cool. Yeah. I've really not even attempted to look at Amiga except for, you know, like at the very like distant level that we've talked about it. But So FSUAE is or UAE generally is the emulator for this. So I think I might start there.
Yeah, that's because I was considering buying real hardware, and then I was like, well, I should start with an emulator and just see, like, is my interest going to stick on this, or so that I don't get stuck with an Amiga 500 in the closet that I'm never going to use because I only had a passing interest in it. But yeah, the emulator, FSUAE is very good.
There are a number of takes on the UAE emulator. I think there's one, there's a package, there's a commercial package, and again, it's to keep track of the names of the different groups. I think it's either Hague and Partner. I can't remember the current owner, but there's a commercial package called Amiga Forever, and it's for the PC. If you have a PC and you want to run the emulator on it, they sell you the ROMs. Like, they have the rights to the ROMs,
right?
You know, so you get the ROMs for all the Amigas, and it has arguably the nicest sort of interface layer on top, you know, and like the number of systems you can emulate and how you can load drives. And it's very clean. I actually purchased it again, years had gone by. You probably ran across Amiga Forever as a PC targeted commercial. That's probably the cleanest. It's commercial. The company that sells it owns the ROMs. And they give you the ROMs, but, I think I paid like $25 for it or something like that. It wasn't much, and but it's PC only, you know, but it's very smooth. But yeah, there's a UAE has been kind of put in various different scenarios. So
yeah, it's definitely solid. Like, it's, I'd say it's somewhere between, like, to compare to Apple IIs, it's somewhere between like Virtual 2 and the GS emulation situation. So it's orders of magnitude better than all the 2GS emulators, which are not that great, but it's not quite as slick as Virtual 2 is. But yeah, it's definitely, it's certainly adequate, and it was very easy to get it running. Like, it was double click and go, basically. It even comes with, like, if you don't have the real Kickstart ROM images from Amiga Forever, or, you know, they do also exist on archive.org. I'm not saying you should download them from there, because they are technically owned by the Amiga Forever people, but the UAE emulator comes with like their own kind of sort of laser 128 versions of the ROMs that are mostly compatible and legal. So you can actually get it up and running without even having the real ROMs at all, which is pretty cool. But yeah, so it was very easy to get up and running for sure.
It's interesting how the Amiga community, like, this seems more pronounced in the Amiga community than in any other hardware community. There's a deep respect for the ownership of the ROMs. Almost nobody else in any with any other machine, and maybe it's just because it's not a going concern, but almost nobody else really respects that sort of thing. They just go download the ROMs and play it until they're tired of it and move on to the next thing.
It's interesting that someone still owns them. You know, I mean, I guess, you know, technically Apple still owns the Apple II ROMs. They refuse to release them, which is, you know, annoying and silly, but it's not like they're going to come after anybody. And of course, the Commodore 64 and other 8-bits are all, you know, those companies are long gone. And Atari, I don't know what it is even Atari anymore. I don't think anybody cares about those either. But I guess technically someone does own all of those as well. Like, someone bought all of the IP belonging to all those things, but, you know, it's not like anyone's going to care. But yeah, Amiga people definitely do still care.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of, I mean, I know there's, you know, the Atari ST, there's, I guess, vintage Mac people, but, like, there are Amiga people that, you know, they will be running an emulator and they're using the Amiga for everything that they do. Like, they're running it on a fast system, so they're using an Amiga that's basically the speed of a modern laptop. But, you know, I guess I'm probably going to get a lot of hate mail for this, but I mean, you know, the fact that it has this Unix-like OS that's very versatile, you know, that doesn't mean that there exists a browser for the system that is capable of even, you know, doing the math required to load a SSL website, you know, but people do a lot of things on it. And I will say, as far as, you know, thinking about, like, you know, Virtual 2, how clean and that's sort of a perfect emulator, you know, there's still some games and demos that the emulator can't do right. I mean, the Amiga is such an extremely complicated architecture. You know, it has these custom chips and everything's being passed back and forth. And, you know, it's the chips have, like, sort of shortcut, like, they're, you know, little aberrant hacks, like how, you know, this allows this to happen, you know, as a bonus effect. You know, it's just, it's so much more complicated than something, you know, like an Apple II, even the 2GS or an Atari ST. I mean, it's just got so many more moving parts that, I don't think there's still this perfect emulation. But it's close, and it's getting closer.
There's lots of demo effects that rely on the exact cycle count between Copper and Denise or whatever, like that. Yeah, nothing is emulating all that perfectly, and maybe never will. There's always going to be stuff that you have to have real hardware for sure. So, kind of on that topic, one thing that's been interesting is the more I learn about the hardware, the more I'm becoming convinced that the machine was always doomed. I mean, and I'm going to get hate mail for this, I know, but you know, the lore is very much about how the machine didn't get a fair shake, and it didn't, to be fair. From 1985 to 1990, let's say, it definitely did not get a fair shake. And much of that was down to how it was positioned to the market by Commodore and all those sorts of things. All true, I'm sure. But let's be honest. I mean, it is absolutely an extremely 2D tailored architecture, and it's extremely aggressively accelerated for doing 2D graphics. And that was going away in the late 80s and early 90s. 2D stuff was dying. And it was, I guess you might say that Doom was what doomed the Amiga. I mean, the Amiga is so poorly set up to do anything 3D, and that's absolutely where everything was going. So, I mean, it was gonna die pretty quickly anyway, even if Commodore hadn't bungled it. And, you know, once again, you can go ahead and send your hate mail to carrington.vanceman@gmail if you want to rant at me about that. But
I'm increasingly convinced
of that.
They saw it, right, the writing on the wall. I mean, it's interesting that I don't know if it was the last Amiga that came out. The CD32 was the second game console, so to speak, that Commodore did with the Amiga hardware. Basically, it was an Amiga 1200 trimmed down without a keyboard. It actually had a chunky to planar chip on it that converted, you know, you could actually write code targeting, you know, chunky pixels, which were basically in one consecutive, you know, byte of memory, you're referring to one pixel, whereas the Amiga being, as what you're referring to being, you know, so 2D oriented that each, like, if you had, you know, a 6-bit screen, you know, showing, you know, 32 colors, 64 colors, it would be different areas of memory. One bit would you'd have to address a bit in completely different areas of memory because they were all held on 1-bit planes. So they added that chip, but it wasn't like it was underpowered. And I know that in the next iteration, the AAA, you know, chipset, which was going to be based on the HP PA RISC, that Commodore, that the Amiga people were working on, that was going to have, you know, chunky graphics modes, of course. But yeah, that they went bankrupt while that was, you know, not very far along in development, and that never came to be. But so interesting.
It is an amazing moment in time, though. I mean, if you wanted to accelerate 2D graphics, it's hard to think of better ways to do it than the Amiga did. I mean, again, the more I learned about the hardware, the more I respect it. It's just so clever. Like, every single idea in it is just like, wow, that's such a good way to do that. It's hard to, I guess, I mean, it might be comparable to something like the Super Nintendo as far as cleverness of acceleration of 2D, you know, several years before that. So and it's also, it's much more flexible than game, you know, game console, 2D game console hardware is extremely focused on tile maps and, you know, those sorts of things. Whereas the Amiga is more like a general 2D acceleration. So you could set up your engine a lot of different ways and still get extremely accelerated 2D. So, the way that it leverages all of those ideas as well. Like I talked about how, you know, you can pull down the screen horizontally or vertically to multitask different apps running at different screen resolutions just by leveraging the horizontal blanking. Like that is such a good idea that it hurts my brain a little bit because I never would have thought of that. And it's such an elegant solution. And because it's supported in the hardware so well, it's so fast and so smooth. Like a modern Mac could not do what it's doing as smoothly and as fast as it was doing that in 1985. So the modern Macs still don't span resolutions very well and still don't smoothly multitask that well in a lot of ways. So really, really impressed. So maybe that'll cancel out some of the hate mail.
Only Amiga makes it possible. Should I start singing?
But it was a dead-end architecture. I'm sorry. Okay, back to the email.
All right. Maybe we can move to the next thing. And actually, I'm going to come back. I think I'm going to come back a little bit to one related point when I get to mine. But first, Blake has Christmas games.
I do indeed. And this is just a quick one. It looks like an interesting little game. What we're talking about is Santa's Workout. One of many C64 games from Vector 5 Games. It's a colorful Christmas, you know, platformer that, you know, shows there's snow, there's elves, there's presents, there's trees, and there's, you know, platform action.
And it's new.
Runs an Indie. And it's new. Yes, it's a new development. Indie Retro News is a nice site now that I think about it. Talking about this, I don't know that there's a better place that I go to see what's happening in as far as new development. I'm not sure how, you know, like Apple II branded they are. I feel like I don't see a lot there, but anyway, these guys cross my radar a lot. But what I just wanted to point it out because we're coming up, it's the holidays, and I always really enjoyed Christmas demos, Christmas games. I'm now looking for the latest Christmas demos written in the last year or two to make a little list. I tweet around Christmas. So anyway, just kind of sharing this for others that, you know, enjoy kind of playing, getting a little bit of the holiday mood through their retro computer, because that was always a fun thing for me as a kid. And I still enjoy it. So, that's about it. But anyway, if you want to grab this, we'll have the link in the show notes, and it has a link to, there's a link to the download. I don't think that's actually a link to the source. And there's some demo videos of it, but looks fun. Overall holiday games, good stuff.
Yeah. There was something that I think we got this in feedback, a sort of similar thing that I was going to talk about and then didn't. But it's an Apple II game also, you know, like Christmas themed Apple II game called The Pudding Strikes Back. One thing that's sort of interesting about this is that it's a double low res game. So the Apple II, like the later iterations of the Apple II had a mode which was double low res, you know, so it had like more pixels, I guess.
The deceptively named double low res.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
And
higher resolution than low res.
So it's something like not very much ever made use of it, I don't think, you know, but there's a library called Dolores, which I think is a great name for a library, that sort of assists in using it. And this, The Pudding Strikes Back was made using this. I downloaded it and played it just a little bit. It's, you know, you sort of move a little crosshair around and shoot at falling Christmas themed objects, you know, but,
I see it supports the Mockingbird sound card, which is always nice, cool. As most new Apple II games do, which is also nice.
So anyway, one thing that actually caused me to, I don't understand what the purpose of this is. There's a pause mode that shows you like a not particularly racy picture. In pause mode, it's like what was the point of adding that? But
that's sort of the opposite of the old spreadsheet, you know, game pauses. Do you remember those?
Yeah, you'd hit the boss key,
boss switch, the boss key. Show up a racy image.
But
yeah, strange.
Anyway, So yeah, I guess it is the season for Christmas-themed games.
The Double Low Res mode is a lot of fun. Like, it's super charming. I mean, it's all of the sharp, clear colors of low res, but with like the bare minimum actually usable resolution, which, you know, yeah. Low res is what, like 40 by 24 40. Or something, and double low res is 80 by 24 or something. But it's enough pixels that you can make a yeah, real game out definitely. Of it, which basic low res really isn't enough pixels to do yeah. anything.
Yeah, it's cool.
I think it's the vertical resolution is 48 because each nibble accounts for
right so. yeah perhaps most famously was Dagenbrock's Flapplebird done in double low res, which honestly looks just as good from a distance as the distance. Pixelated aesthetic of the original iPhone game
sure.
did. So
sure,
it's got plenty of pixels to do a game like that and have that yeah, charm.
That is
mm-hmm. yeah, there it is on screen. Yeah,
that is it is amazing. Actually, that game.
Yeah, it's incredibly yeah. well implemented, yeah. and I mean that's, you know, as many or more pixels as a lot of the modern retro systems have, like the Pico right. 8 and right. the Playdate and so on. So it's plenty of pixels to do a real game, but and still have all the fun colors, unlike, you know, the Apple II high-res mode, which is punishingly painful color-wise.
I guess you'd know, Quinn, you're still bound by the maniacal arrangement of video memory, so to speak, in the two, even in double low-res mode, right?
Yeah, and that's how it works, is that it does the same trick that double high-res does to high-res. It interleaves every other bit with the auxiliary memory page. So writing pixels to double low-res is extremely painful. But that's where something like Dolores comes in, that library that kind of abstracts that away for you, does the heavy lifting of writing all those pixels. And performance-wise, it's much easier because double high-res, it's extremely difficult to get usable performance out of it because you're having right. to write all these bits in very complicated memory patterns all over both banks. And so the double low-res also solves a lot of that problem. It's still a very complicated memory layout, but it's so few pixels that it's much easier performance-wise to do it.
Yeah, someday that'll be a project I will do.
Yeah, I would also like to do something.
That's a nice move.
Double low-res.
All right. The last thing here I have is this actually came from feedback, but so Sean wrote over email about this Register article about Elite, the BBC Micro game. So this actually, the article is relatively new. It was in the Register November 17th, so pretty recently. But it's talking about source code to Elite that was released a few years ago. So this, it's not exactly a new new news thing, but it points to a site, bbcelite.com, which is basically a very deep dive into the source code. So it's kind of like a series of essays and a series of tech notes and stuff about sort of like all the different versions of it, and kind of walking through like how it did all the various little tricks. It is really something. I mean, I have only scratched the surface of this site, but if you have any interest in, Elite and how it did things, this is definitely worth checking out.
That's really cool. I played the Apple II version of this back in the day. I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. At the time, I wasn't old enough to appreciate how they were doing it. It's mm-hmm. for anyone who doesn't know, it's kind of the original procedurally generated content game, mm-hmm. the No Man's Sky of its day, with based on a single pseudo random number generator in a given seed. It would just generate all the planets and all of the everything that you needed, so the galaxy seemed infinitely enormous, all, you know, on very limited memory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing that I noticed when I was sort of flipping through this site is something that reminded me a lot, actually, of what you were talking about with respect to the Amiga, which is, the split-screen mode. So Elite, let's see if I can find a screenshot. Somewhere there must be a screenshot. But anyway, the top part of the screen on a BBC Micro is a sort of wireframe, you know, rendering of ships flying around and stuff. And then the lower part of the screen is in color. And that is actually done by switching video modes at the particular like scan line. When it, you know, it basically sets a timer at the top when it hits a vertical refresh, and waits until it gets, you know, an appropriate time later when mm-hmm. the scan line will be, or the beam will be down a certain thing. It'll generate an interrupt and then switch video modes to get into the color. And that's really cool. I mean, like, there's a lot going on in this game. And of course, that particular thing probably was not, aspect of the ports, but it was something in the BBC Micro version.
Yeah,
that method was also very common on the Atari 8-bits because they also had horizontal scanline interrupts, and so a lot of the Atari games would have like even two or three different zones on the screen, like a score bar at the top, and then the gameplay in the middle, and like a player HUD at the bottom. That would all be in different video modes, different color depths, different text modes, etc., to get whatever was optimal for that particular mode. It's interesting how the hardware dictates the look of these games. So the Atari games all have that horizontal banded look. Apple II games always had stuff on the right. They always had that player score, artwork, whatever, on the right, because that meant all of your math could be in the 8 bits on the left without having to limit your horizontal resolution to 256. So the Apple II games all had that look instead.
And as I'm sure you're aware, Quinn, but I'll mention it for anyone that might not be, indeed, the Atari chipset, of course, was the predecessor to the Amiga, or the Amiga, I guess, more accurately was the successor of the 8-bit. Same designer.
Same team.
Good stuff. It's interesting. I will say, I wish I had gotten into it. I had it, and I played it a little bit on the Apple II. I wish I'd gotten more into it. I got much more interested in it about 10 years ago, and I've got a whole bunch of different versions of it. And just for people that want to check it out, it was a programming marvel, in particular on the original BBC Micro and some of the other systems of the day. But the nicest version I've seen that's not like super modern, such that it kind of gets away from its roots. The version that developer David Braben says is his favorite version of the, of the quote original, back in the day versions, is the NES version, the Nintendo version. There is a version of Elite for the NES. It's a little tricky with emulation because it's a PAL game, and apparently a lot of the emulators don't properly handle PAL, or they don't handle the Elite ROM that I have easily, but I did finally get it set up. But it's nice because rather than having to know everything on the keyboard, it actually has, screen help with, it has a little interface on the screen as part of the cockpit, so to speak. But it still feels like the original game. So if you want to check it out and you want a light way to do it, and a very good version, to check out the NES version. Apparently that's the way to go. So.
Well, if one of the challenges with Elite, I think, is that the graphics have not aged super well. So, but if someone's interested in playing this style of procedurally generated space game with graphics that are maybe still have some of their retro charm, two recommendations I have are Sundog on the Apple II, which is an outstanding game. Again, procedurally generated space flight and trading and so on. But then there's also really nice planet landing modes where you can run around in the towns and you can go into bars and get into gunfights in bars and all sorts of fun stuff. The graphics are really, really delightful. And then a later Origin game called Space Rogue and Space Rogue actually has solid fill graphics, solid fill 3D, polygon 3D on the Apple II, which performance-wise, not the best, but if you can get past that, it also, then you can land on space stations, and it has a full, Ultima tile-based engine, as Origin often did for running around on the space stations and trading and so on. So both excellent games for that style.
Cool. All right. The clock has ticked on quite a ways, so let us now go to a word from our sponsor.
Some home computers are already obsolescent. Their memory limited. Their performance slow. So now a team of software engineers have designed the Enterprise. Unlike its predecessors, the Enterprise's memory can expand to a massive 3,900K. And being the younger generation, it even offers stereo sound. The Enterprise 128. It could be obsolescence built out.
It has two wheels and two sources of power, goes from 0 to 192 in one shift, and can take you places just standing still. Yamaha DX100 synthesizer. Anything's possible.
And we're back. So the host's retro computing gift idea is the thinking cap. I don't think we've used this before. This is from Joe's Computer Museum, and it is a cap that has the print shop thinking graphic on it. And I just thought it was kind of funny that it was called the thinking cap. So
that's good. I like it.
It's $22.50.
A very small number of people will find that delightful.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. It's another one of those things where if you have that on, I mean, some people will just find it like a funny joke just on its own. They won't understand what the thinking means at a different level. But if you find someone who understands all of that, you want that person to be your friend.
Exactly. Wear it with your Beagle Brothers bag, yep, and be friends for life.
There's another couple of cool things here as well. Joe's Computer Museum. I hadn't come across this, and so I thought I would bring it up. He also sells a Neethernet adapter. Have you come across this? It's
no.
So, you know, old Macs, you could connect with these AppleTalk, you know, or I think the AppleTalk is the name of it. The little connectors that you would network among, and then eventually Farallon came along and said, all right, we can do the same thing, but we can use like phone cords, you know, instead of these like specialized cables. The Neethernet is a further evolution of that idea, using Ethernet cables. So because nobody has phone cables anymore, but everybody has Ethernet cables. So it's a phone net adapter, except for Ethernet cables. So it doesn't actually, it's not Ethernet. It's just, you know, AppleNet, AppleTalk.
It's not an active converter. It's just an adapter.
Yeah, right. It's an AppleTalk
like
connector.
Ones, yeah. Nice.
But
nice.
Anyway, I thought it was a neat idea. I had never come across it before. So
yeah, it's a good idea. I don't even know where I would buy a phone cord now. Yeah. So that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So, and also there's a universal Apple RGB adapter for your Apple III that he sells. So I think positively on Joe's Computer Museum. I, in fact, have one of these. Let's see. Within reach. I haven't actually tried it out, but I do have it, and it basically plugs into the back of the Apple III. The Apple III has a RGB out that goes to a very specific monitor, which is very expensive and heavy. And if you don't have that monitor, this little adapter will allow you to connect to a 2GS monitor, which is less heavy and less rare. Or it also has a composite out that can output color if you want to. So, and actually also can connect to a CGA monitor too, I think. So,
nice.
All you Apple III people, don't start buying up all the GS monitors we still need.
Yes, right, exactly. And this actually also works with an Apple IIe that has a RGB card in it as well. So,
right.
So anyway, various things to get.
So that's like six people total.
Yeah. That's right.
In the world, Apple III people and RGB IIe card people.
Yeah. But anyway, the main thing is the thinking cap.
Yes.
Okay. So once you're done buying your various friend-making apparel items, we can turn to eBay, and Blake has the first of the things to look at there.
I do. I think I'm just going to do two of my items here today. So the first is, and I think I've talked about this. This has come across the radar maybe like a little over a year ago, and I talked about it before, and I'll talk about it again. Ultra Rare Vintage Enterprise 128 computer system, boxed, very good condition, $599 currently, GBP, actually. I mentioned this because well, it has interesting additional little nugget of interest for me personally. Mm-hmm. But the Enterprise 128, I've said before that, in my opinion, the most powerful 8-bit processor is probably the 6809, like in the color computer, or I guess the Hitachi, super version of that, which I can never remember the model number of. But it seems pretty, you can measure that pretty easily. But I was in a discussion on forums about that, and someone, I mentioned, oh, so the Coco 3, perhaps the most powerful 8-bit computer. And a number of people responded pointing to the specs of the Enterprise 128, and it actually, it's not using a 6809. I think it uses a honestly, I can't recall if it's a Z80 or a 6502, but it has the combination of its memory, I think the way its system is architected, the graphics that it has. I mean, it's not like an Amiga or something, but in the day, and it's 8-bit. This seems to come up with a common sort of agreement from some that it's perhaps the most powerful overall 8-bit home computer. So I always find it interesting. What makes it particularly interesting for me is someone offered me one of these free. They said, I'll mail it to you. They were in England. They said, I'll send this to you. Would you like it? I know you might be interested. And I said, I don't have the desk space, and I didn't know anything about it. And I said, I just, I don't want you to do that. I don't have any place to put it. Mm-hmm. And so it went away. And then I learned, how it's this, really interesting system. And there's a lesser memory version. This is the 128. I mean, I kicked myself. I can't believe I didn't, and here it's right now, it's already at like for US dollars, what, 700 and some in this auction. So, yeah, that was painful. But anyway, so if you want and I'm not going to go into great detail of the history of the system. And I honestly don't have a full breadth of knowledge of that, but it's an interesting item, and I don't think you see these in this condition come across eBay very often. So
what is the thing in the lower right? Is that a joystick?
It's a joystick.
I think it's either broken off or not included in this auction.
Okay. Yeah, I was looking at that. It looks like the stick is gone. I was assuming because they say very good condition and it's boxed and it's wrapped in these pictures that maybe it's removable and in the box. I would want to check that before I ordered.
Yeah. You can see a picture of it on the front of the box, like how it's supposed to be.
I see. Okay.
I bet it's removable.
Yeah, it probably is. It's. I believe it can be used for games, obviously, but also as a cursor. I think that's its cursor control. As well, so that's kind of cool. But anyway,
it's a neat looking machine.
Yeah, I like the colors.
Neat little system.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The colors and the keycaps are sort of kind of like they remind me of the Apple IIc a little bit mm-hmm. in the way that like the shape of them.
They're not gradual. They're sort of like a square key base, and then not quite all the way to the edge.
Yeah.
There's a...
Exactly, a kind of shouldered key design, yeah. I like that look.
I think NCR used to make keyboards like this as well for their business systems, I think, from what I remember in magazines. But it's a nice little system.
Yeah. So it's conceivable, actually, that this is overestimating its value, but I don't know.
I think it'll sell. I would imagine it'll sell. I've seen them go for higher than this.
Okay.
Well, actually, $791. I was thinking $599 U.S. dollars, but it's $791 U.S. dollars. Anyway, I don't think it's egregiously out of range, but maybe on the high side. But all right, and then quickly on to the other item. And this one is, I'm mentioning this just, hold on a second, just as kind of a curiosity, kind of like a, what's in this thing? Here's an Apple IIgs computer. And I actually I sent an email asking if, interior pictures, what's inside. So it's a 2GS. And I've lately seen this type of thing before. It's a seller. They've sold 19,000 items. They're not like an Apple II, they're not Apple focused or even computer focused, I don't think. So he's got an Apple IIgs. It's got an Apple sticker on the front, unfortunately. It also has a Grappler-powered sticker on the front. So either it does currently, or at one point, it had a Grappler printer interface, parallel printer or serial buffered printer interface.
And these are not those are not precious things. I mean, those are things actively try to get rid of.
You take out. Yeah, right. The auction could go higher if they were to remove the Grappler card from the machine, but So it's, you look at the back, you can't really tell much about the back and the pictures. They've got pictures at the bottom, the side. There's lots and lots of pictures. Just zoom in on the power light. Got another picture of the front. Here's a, they got a, there's a tape measure showing the width and height of this Apple 2GS, so you can tell whether or not it's a miniature or a giant mutation. But the thing is, so clearly this person doesn't know anything about it. But you wonder what's in it. Like, you know, it's right now at the current bid, it's not a buy it now. It's an auction, $82. Time left 3 days. You know, it could have a transwarp.
Yeah,
a Vulcan drive. You know, it could have all these things in it, and something like this, 82 gets out of there. But you know, even like, you know, it's got something in it. Like, it probably has that grappler card. But you know, maybe, and they were happy about it because they put a sticker on the front about the grappler.
Yeah.
So maybe this enthusiast, you know, has got. It could be like a unicorn, and you don't know. And just some part of me, you know, would just be pretty interested in taking a chance and seeing what's inside of the thing, but it probably is just a grappler card, you know.
Yeah,
it's like you open it, I don't know what I expected. So do you get that feeling? Do you encounter that sometimes when you're looking at an eBay auction? This is just a good example, and I wanted to point it out.
Yeah, I mean,
either of you guys,
you never know. I mean, sometimes you can get hints. I mean, so always the first thing you do is like you look at the back and see like what ports are sticking out. Can you see evidence of a card that is desirable? And it is tempting, but I bet most of the time it turns out that there's like you know, a RAM card in there if you're lucky.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's you know, I saw somebody on Facebook. I think it was like, you know, 5 months ago, went to the, you know, like the Goodwill, right? And for whatever reason, there was an Apple 2GS there. And it was, did terrible, you know, there was paint on it or something. He brought it out, and it had a transwarp in it. It had like a, you know, some kind of focus, like a focus drive. You know, it was quite a find. Yeah, it's just, it's sort of intriguing.
It is funny, though, that these things are finds. They're finds, really, if you're presenting them to the right person. I mean, because if you present them to the wrong person, this is like a bunch of junk. You know,
even
if it has a card that was expensive in the day.
Right. And I mean, and again, you're not hearing the stories, you know, I got a 2GS, it saw it at the Goodwill, and it was missing its power supply. You know, and its owner said its called name is Lucky. You know, you don't hear about those, but anyway, so that got my interest, but that's all I've got for eBay right now.
Okay.
Do you want to move?
Yeah, let's see. So I have a couple. Okay, so the first one that I want to talk about actually ended, but it was brought to my attention. It sold for $300. It looks like it was a buy it now. It was coming out of Buenos Aires, but it is a TK2000. Color computer Apple II clone from Brazil. And what's, I feel like we may have talked about this before, but the thing that's funny about it is it really looks like an Atari. I mean, it is
exactly like an Atari 1200 XL. Yeah.
Yeah. It is a Atari shaped Apple II clone. And so anyway, I just thought it was kind of a nifty thing. There isn't one presently for sale. This is just the one, you know, the one that sold a little while ago.
Is that a slot on the side?
I think it looked like it was. You know, so in order to be whatever Apple II compatible, you have to be able to put in a card dangling off the side like it does in the lasers.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that looks so much like a 1200 XL.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw this go around. Is it literally an Atari case, or does it just really look like an Atari?
I think it just looks like it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it could easily be, you know, some fell off a truck.
Yeah, that's honestly what I wondered. Like, if the original Atari cases were maybe made in Brazil or something, that maybe the company also had a bunch of them, so they made these.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking at the 1200 XL case, and it's got on its side, it has a sort of angular arrangement. Like it has a hole where the slot is, but it's bigger. Yeah. And it has those distinctive, that was the angular thing I thought I was remembering, the cool angled joystick connectors.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know,
that's
like,
cool.
You, the keyboard on the 1200 XL, is apparently extremely high quality. And just unfortunately, they made an 8-bit Atari that's not really compatible with 8-bit Atari systems exactly. So, you know.
If you look at where the mold line is, though, on the 1200 XL, I think I would not be surprised if it's the same top shell piece, because the lower shell piece is what has the angled joystick ports and the other differences in the Atari. So I think and if you look at where that TK2000 badging is, that's where that silver row is on the 1200 XL. So I would bet you anything that it is the same top plastic mold.
Weird.
It's very, very close. Like the vents look identical. The dimensions look the same. That's interesting.
Apparently, the letters Q, W, Z, X, and V were not very frequently used on this.
Wow, yeah. That the inking on those keys must have been very poor quality because they are all worn off.
Yeah.
Well, you could just, you know, come up with combinations of the worn keys and you'll figure out their lengthy, lengthy password.
Yeah.
It looks like somebody wrote a dozen novels on that thing. Like every single key is worn off.
It got some use.
Anyway, So I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
Even if it is not active, but
I will say I always have considered the 1200 XL to be one of the very most attractive case designs I've ever seen. I don't know if anyone shares my fondness. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very nice looking machine. It's a shame about what's in it, but the case is really nice. Once again, send your hate mail to carrington.vanston@gmail.com.
Okay, let's see. What else do I have? This is another one that that Ian pointed out, actually. It's a Covox Voicemaster Key System 2. And I don't actually know very much about it, but it looks kind of nice. It is a speech synthesizer, and it has a parallel connection. Maybe it's serial, but kind of non-computer specific connector, which means that you could conceivably use this with probably it's serial now that I think about it, but with almost any computer. So I think it mentions the PC on the literature here, but I sort of assume that there could be software at least that could interface with almost any computer that could connect to that.
I assume it's the same speech chip that was in all quote-unquote speech synthesizers back then. Like it was like the chip they developed for the Speak and Spell or whatever. It was the same, like it was the one on the Mockingbird, and like every so-called speech thing used that same chip that wasn't that good, but was amazing at the time, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sort of interesting. $195, buy it now. I don't find it interesting enough for that, but it's neat.
If it is serial, that means you could still talk to it today. Yeah. You could talk to it with an Arduino or something, which actually might be kind of cool.
It would be interesting. You could put the Arduino inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hook it up to your Alexa somehow, interface it with a Raspberry Pi or something, talk to Alexa. It'd be kind of fun.
One of those because you can projects.
Yeah, exactly. It would be totally unintelligible, but you could have Alexa talk to you like it's 1985.
I thought this was kind of interesting. This is how to use the Commodore 64. An Alfred handy guide. Alfred made a bunch of these kind of these shaped guides, you know, so there's all kinds of different topics, but this is it's sort of like a pamphlet that you pay $3 for. But this is showing you how to use the Commodore 64. You can sort of see it's just sort of like a little mini book. So it's kind of on the same theme as the like tutorials on how to use the Amiga, right?
The Commodore on the front is blue, though. That's throwing me off.
Yeah, it is kind of strange.
Why is it blue?
I don't know. It is interesting. But I thought maybe it would work well for the the blue Kickstarter case.
Wow, did you?
I served you right up for that transition.
Did you talk about this before the show began? What?
We didn't.
No.
I'm a straight man, apparently, for this show.
Yeah. So, anyway, what I showed on the screen was a video for someone who put together the Commodore 64 blue case. There was a Kickstarter for this. It's actually a 64C, I think, or whatever it is, the slightly different shaped non-bread bin version.
Non-bread bin.
Yeah. But... So, particularly if you have the blue one, this pamphlet is for you.
Well, Well, I like it on the front of the pamphlet. The blue Commodore is also resplendent in his regalia, military
Commodore
sword, hat, and
he's a Commodore. He's Commodore. A naval officer.
I get it. Right? I get it. I'm just
just in case anyone didn't get it. Yeah.
Okay, and then I guess the last thing was just on the speech synthesis theme. It's an Echo Plus. It's a card for an Apple II. Is one of the sort of popular ones in schools, at least as far as I know. I mean, like, it was in my school. I guess that's, we were talking about that before, I guess, with our school experiences. Like, if it was in your school, you think it was popular in schools, even though no other schools had it.
Exactly. Yeah, I certainly never had these in schools, but I do remember these. And this was that chip for sure that I was talking about that everything had at the speak and spell chip.
Yeah. You know? So there's a little external speaker that you plug into the card, and there's various variants of this. Blake is digging out one of his, I suspect.
Yes.
So if you wanted one of these, this one actually comes with the little speaker.
Nice.
There's an Easter egg though in this. Can you go back to the first photo?
Yeah, I thought that was also pretty bizarre.
Yeah, in the first photo of this thing in the box, there's 2GS. A picture of the Apple IIgs toolbox reference, Volume 3, which is the rare one, interestingly enough.
Really? That I didn't know.
One and 2 were very common, and then they added a Volume 3 much later, and it was kind of after the heyday of the GS, and so they didn't stock it in technical bookstores and stuff, so very few copies of this actually are around. So, like, I've never actually been able to find a physical copy of it, but I have 1 and 2 were ubiquitous. So,
and it's randomly selected with this auction. I mean, it's an Echo Plus auction with also, you know, a 2GS toolbox reference book.
Volume 3. Yeah. Interesting. Sorry, I cut you off there, Blake. Were you going to show off your...
No, I was just... Echo? Yeah, the Echo Plus from Street Electronics is... Yeah, it's the brother to the more rare Cricket sound box, which was for the Apple IIc. I think it's basically a version of the Echo that it has the dual the same chips. Yamaha based clones of the Yamaha chips from the Mockingboard, along with that same speech chip that everyone's familiar with. I think the Echo Plus may or may not have music, but the Cricket has music as well.
Oh, so it's it's also a music box. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's a Mockingboard C, sort of as far as the hardware mix. It's got the two audio chips, 6 channels, and it has the voice, but it's, you know, through serial. Like the Mockingboard D for the Apple IIc, almost nothing supports it, but it's even worse as far as support because it's not a Mockingboard at all. It's something else. I think the only thing that supports it, I opened it up and looked at the hardware. It's the same hardware, on a Mockingboard C, but it's, I think music instruction set is the only thing that supports it. That's it. Uh-huh. Aside from some, dev tools that came with it. Program your own set music kind of thing. But yes, Echo Plus is almost the same device minus music.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, there were a couple of different versions of this card. Like there's an Echo 2 and like a 2B, I think. And this is the Echo Plus. And I don't really know how they differ.
It seems like they were just different variants of music or not music or, you know, only music or music and speech or only speech, you know, I feel like there's no music on that thing, but you know,
I think I have a couple of different Echo cards that I, you know, I got them for the nostalgic reason and I have yet to play with them, but,
I hesitate to suggest this, but buying something like one of these might be actually a good way to get those speech chips for your Mockingboard because those two chips are never populated because it was an optional add-on. And those chips now are super unobtainium. Like you cannot get them anywhere. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if you could buy one of these a lot cheaper and pull those speech chips off it.
Could be. Particularly, I mean, like this might not be the best set to do that with because it is so complete, but I mean like the Echo cards, you know, you can find them just
You see those a lot, I think.
Yeah, loose. So
it's interesting.
Cool. Okay, that's it for mine. I think we're done with the eBay auctions. Congratulations, everybody. We have made it. So I guess we've made it to closing discussions. My recording seems to have only been going for a little over 2 hours, so it's not bad. Blake, any sort of closing notes?
I guess I'll say, you know, I mentioned earlier in the show that the Apple 2GS over my left shoulder that you can see, which is fired up, I've just been
that's the angel and the devil ones on the other shoulder.
That's right. Yeah, the devil over here and the angel over here. Yes, I've just been, for whatever reason, I fired it up and I've been grabbing. I fairly recently added a CFFA 3000 to the GS. I have one in the 2E. I know everyone should have one CFFA 3000 before anyone has two, but still,
they're making them. They're remaking them now, though.
I know. I think they're doing it now. Oh, you bought one a long time ago, Quinn. You don't have a slotted Apple II, right?
Nope, I have one sitting in my closet because I do own two slotted Apple IIs, but they are 2,000 miles away. But someday I will be in the same room with them and I will have a CFFA for them.
That's what you want to have for them. Yeah, it's lovely. But anyway, I've just been loading out a friend of mine. He had a arcade that he built, the Luna City Arcade, which was located about an hour west of me in northwestern Virginia. That I visited and did a little video of. He wrote some iOS games, and more recently he's been writing Apple II GS games. He picked up a GS and immediately started cranking out assembly language arcade perfect conversions for it. One of them is Pac-Man, and I've been playing a lot of that. He also created an awesome Asteroids game for the 2GS, which even has like an anti-aliased mode. If you have an accelerator, it's very impressive. Now that I've talked so much about it, we should probably put a link in the show notes. But anyway, so I've been having fun with the GS this weekend. I hadn't turned it on, and it had been a few months actually, so it's nice to spend time with a GS, and it is nice also to have an accelerator for it. you appreciate after spending time copying things in the GSOS, that kind of thing. So that's been fun, and probably turn it off in the next day or two and move on to a different machine. But yeah, that's it for me.
Excellent. Let's see. For me, I have been, I've been doing a lot of scanning and imaging and things like that. Finally, sort of, like my plan is to reduce the number of things that I have, and so I'm treating everything now as like this. Maybe the last chance I have to interact with it, I'm going to scan it, I'm going to image it, and then it is going to be gone. It's interesting. I've been opening a few things, and it's interesting to see how they work and don't. it is a little annoying to open something up and then find that it just, you know, the disk is just bad. I've now found two disks. I'm not sure if they were both in things that I opened, but two discs that were, I can see were mastered off center. So like the image, the applesauce imager can tell, it can sort of show you, and you can sort of see how the tracks are like not around the circle hole.
Interesting.
So they never worked, you know, that certainly doesn't boot now, but, I guess, you know, it is sort of interesting that happens. I don't actually know how that happens, but there's one in particular. It was Galaxy, Avalon Hill Galaxy. So like, you know, the old sort of like strategy game, and it was TRS-80 on one side and Apple II on the other, because Avalon Hill would often do that. And the TRS-80 side is fine. The Apple side is mastered off center. So
really
interesting.
So is it that they have some sort of a cylindrical magnet that sits down on a floppy and imprints it, or is that, I mean, how else would it, how would you rotate, you know, it can't have been writing while rotating.
I have no idea. I mean, I suppose it could have clamped it in off center or something, like so the Apple II drive, I can't make it go off center, like I've because the way it works, it's got a little cone that goes into the hole and it sort of spreads out to fill up the whole space. So you can't, I for a while I experimented a little bit with like trying to put it off center and then jam the thing down really hard, but I mean, it didn't work. And looking at the mechanics of it, I think it can't work. But it could be that maybe the duplicator houses had some other way to grab it. I don't know.
Interesting.
But, Yeah. So anyway, I've been populating my archive.org page with many scans and things like that, and it's interesting. I will probably talk more about that at some point. The Curtis asked in the chat if it was shootout at the LK Galaxy, but that's a different one. I have that somewhere, but that's not this. This was just called Galaxy. It actually is a really kind of nice cover too, but unfortunately it doesn't work for the Apple II. at least that copy didn't.
I was just saying, I wouldn't have guessed that that would be something that would happen off center. That never occurred to me.
Well, the thing is that, only with this modern technology can we see what happened. I mean,
right. Yeah. You'd know, you wouldn't know otherwise.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You'd never know otherwise that that's what's wrong with them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost scary. Like to see that, like, oh gosh, look at this.
Yeah.
I now understand. I don't know. It's yeah, creepy.
Back something. In the day, you would have just sent it back as a warranty or whatever. You could never know why it didn't
right.
work.
Exactly. But right. on the image, you can sort of see how it's bent in this really kind of weird way. So
that's cool.
You should post that, like an image, like a visual of that somewhere. That would be interesting to see.
Sure. Yeah. I will tweet that months before this hits the feed, no doubt. But hopefully, no, I'll try to remember to set that up. But okay, Quinn, any closing cool. notes?
Yeah. I mean, just I'm going to keep playing with that Amiga stuff. I'm working hard to resist the urge to start diving into the programming stuff because I try very hard to finish previous projects before I start new ones, and that will actually motivate me to maybe finish my GS game before I start on an Amiga something. I really need to do that. I have started making more progress on that, my eternal 2GS project that will never end, and I'm starting to get somewhere with it, so hopefully I can make some forward progress. The excitement of the new thing is often, I find, very useful for motivating me to finish the current thing. So rather than just starting new things willy-nilly and never finishing anything, which is what I used to do in my youth. So yeah, fingers crossed I can get some time and motivation to do that.
Excellent.
Cool. Nifty.
All right. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show on the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time...
Retro compute.